What is the most spontaneous thing you can remember doing? Welcome again to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author for our 13-week study on the Gospel of Mark. We're entering our second lesson, and I'm delighted to have as conversation partners with me this week, Dr. Phil Mothersbaugh, adjunct professor at Walla Walla and pastor, and Dr. Alden Thompson, who was one of my teachers at the university here years ago and is now an emeritus professor and still contributor to our community ministry. Can you think of something spontaneous that you've done, or are you the type of person who doesn't do things spontaneously?
Well, I do things spontaneously, Brant. I think the most spontaneous thing that I can remember doing, and there were probably several, but the one that sticks was taking flight lessons when I was about a third-year college student. I decided my dad was a pilot. I thought maybe it'd be fun to learn how to fly, so I signed up for flying lessons. And
you,
survived.
Did you complete it? Did you become a private pilot?
I did not become a private pilot, but I did make it through my solo, which was an amazing experience to take a machine off the ground and fly around and put the thing back on the ground without destroying myself in the process.
Wonderful. Alden, how about you?
I couldn't come up with anything spontaneously.
And knowing you as I do, your life is very carefully planned usually, and that doesn't surprise me. For many people in the world, spontaneity is part of their life. In fact, I know, like, my daughter loves to have a free weekend so that she can just, at the spur of the moment, drop of a hat, go up to the mountains and run to the hills and hike or take her bike to the coast. And some people like that and some do not. Our lesson today in the Gospel of Mark takes us through the first chapter and into the second. And we see Jesus immediately after he has his baptism experience. He goes to his disciples. He goes to the Sea of Galilee. He calls men to follow him as disciples. And it says, immediately they left their nets and they followed him. Now, we've already mentioned in a previous lesson that the Gospel of Mark uses this word immediately or suddenly. It uses the word throughout the book to drive the narrative forward. Mark uses the word more than Matthew and Luke combined. And that's interesting. And here it says they immediately left their nets. And it seems to some that the call of the first disciples is a bit abrupt. Their response seems spontaneous. Jesus happens along the shore. He says, why don't you guys come and follow me? And they say, hey, great idea. Let's leave our nets and go. And they leave behind their father, their boats, the nets. So is it true in the text, do you think, that this was a spontaneous event, or are we missing something? What could have preceded this that made them willing to leave and follow Jesus?
I would say that there was something compelling about Jesus. I don't think that necessarily fishermen move immediately if they saw a catch of fish off the side of the boat, but I don't think that was what compelled them when Jesus came by. There was something about Jesus that compelled them to take him seriously. And there may have been more to the conversation, but the key word is, the key phrase is, follow me. And they knew that meant giving up their career.
They knew that meant a life of discipleship. Rabbis in the first century called people, didn't they? What do you think, Alden? Is this a spontaneous event? Or
it looks very spontaneous to me. Jesus just comes along and says, hey, you, follow me. And they do.
And they're compelled. If they are fishermen, part of me thinks, hey, I wonder if following a rabbi is a better life. Because rabbis called disciples. This was not unusual for people to follow a rabbi. But typically, the rabbi would have parents come bringing their teenage children and saying, hey, would you take on my son as a disciple so he can become a rabbi as well? It would have been odd to have a rabbi go out to the shores of Galilee and handpick people from the poorer class and not from the higher castes. Come, follow me. And now they've been given an opportunity that people like them don't usually get, to follow a rabbi. Little do they know how much it's going to change their life and the world, right? As Jesus and his disciples begin to travel together, we see Jesus' ministry described in a unique way. It says, Jesus taught as having authority and not like the scribes. What is it that the scribes would have been doing that Jesus' teaching was so much better? How is he different than what they were used to?
Well, when you study the rabbinic writings, one of the things that's true is that the rabbis never speak without citing a whole string of authorities.
Correct.
According to. But when Jesus spoke, he just spoke, and somehow the people said he spoke with authority, not as the rabbis. So there was something where he didn't need to cite anybody else.
But isn't this a little odd? So both of you have advanced degrees, and my guess is that you would not have passed your doctoral work if you had not cited other people as authorities on the topic, right?
But that's academic work.
Maybe we're doing it wrong. Maybe not. But Jesus spoke with authority. He spoke straight from Torah rather than using the authority of the tradition of the elders before them, right? As you said, this long string of other people. Phil, are we missing anything here?
No, I think Alden makes a very good point. When Jesus spoke, there was something compelling about the way he did it. Mark doesn't give us a lot of detail here, but if you go to the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, the other synoptics, there are details that are spelled out there that help you see that he was not interested in citing a string of rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
He was speaking from Scripture.
One of the features in Mark that we see frequently is also noted right here at the beginning of the book and continues on. Jesus goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and there's a man with an unclean spirit. And if we had time, we could talk about demon possession versus mental health issues. That could take up a lot of time and discussion. But after Jesus casts the demon out, or actually during the conversation with the demons in chapter 1, verses 23 through 27, the spirit says, "We know who you are. You're the Holy One of God." And Jesus commands the evil spirit to be quiet. And we're going to see this theme throughout the Gospel of Mark. And it's come to be known as the Messianic secret. Do you gentlemen believe there's actually a secret in Mark? Does Jesus try and keep his ministry quiet? And if so, why would he do so? Why doesn't he just say, "Hey, announce it everywhere, who I am and what I'm about"?
Well, the fact that he speaks constantly of a secret is crucial. But why he does that, it's not clear at all. Everyone goes out and spreads the word. So they disobey Jesus, quite frankly.
We know from Old Testament scholarship especially that Jesus was not the first one to carry the title Messiah. There were others who claimed to be Messiahs, but quickly flamed out. For Jesus to be identified with all the others that had shown up before this, by some he was considered just another individual who had aspirations of greatness, but there wasn't going to be anything to follow through on it. But Jesus' ministry and Jesus' interaction with other people was vastly different from these other so-called messiahs.
Mm-hmm. We see them mentioned in the book of Acts. Gamaliel talks about how their attempts at, you know, kind of insurrection had failed, right? We get a hint of this messianic secret at the end of Mark 1, Jesus again preaching and teaching in the synagogues throughout Galilee, and a person with leprosy, we today might diagnose it as Hansen's disease or something similar. He comes to Jesus and he asks Jesus if Jesus will heal him, if Jesus is willing. And I love the phrase, Jesus is moved with compassion. Now, I think there's some versions that say indignation, but compassion. Compassion moved the heart of Jesus for people. If we take nothing else away from the Gospels, I hope we see that Jesus, representing God, is compassionate. He loves people. He is moved by people's plight. He is overjoyed by their joys. And in this case, Jesus says, "I am willing to heal you." And Jesus stretched out his hand and he touched him. Of course, in that culture, touching an unclean person would make you ritually impure, defiled. You would have to wash. You would have to go through the ceremonial cleansings required by Levitical law. Go show yourself to the priest. But in this case, it just seems like everywhere Jesus touches people, instead of him catching their disease, they catch his health. His health is contagious. And that's a unique picture. But then after he heals the man, he says to him, "Go and see that you say nothing to anyone, but go and show yourself to the priest," because the priest could diagnose him, right? "And then offer the cleansing that Moses commanded as a testimony." But verse 45 says, "But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the news around to such an extent that Jesus could no longer publicly enter a city, but stayed out in unpopulated areas, and they were coming to him from everywhere. Gives us a hint, doesn't it, about why the messianic secret might have been important for Jesus' ministry? What happens when this man blabs this truth?
He makes it impossible for Jesus to continue his work among the people. One suspicion is that, as we see in this gospel and in the other gospels, Jesus is accused of using demonic power. Jesus was not interested in performing signs. He was interested in proclaiming the truth and encouraging people to believe the good news that salvation had come to Israel. Finally, by this man's action, he restricted Jesus' ability to work among the people in that particular area.
How much must that have broken Jesus' heart to not be able to go into the places where there were the most people with the greatest needs, right? Inside the urban areas, the centers of the villages. Instead, Jesus had to stay out because he wasn't able to move freely. If you watch movie stars or sports stars, they get the paparazzi following them, right? And the crowds of people clamoring for autographs. That's Jesus now, right? That's Jesus. As we close, Jesus touches this man. How meaningful is it to have important, appropriate touch in our lives?
Touching is incredibly important as far as people's health is concerned. A hug, a touch.
A high five, a handshake.
And especially in this culture where, again, as you pointed out, Dr. Berglund, that to touch someone who was considered unclean made you unclean. And for Jesus to openly violate that rule raised a lot of eyebrows.
It did, not just because of the ritual purity, but I think for this man who needed touch and was an outcast, Jesus showed he was willing to violate those taboos. Well, our time is already up again for our second study on the book of Mark. I want to say thank you to Dr. Alden Thompson and Dr. Phil Mothersbaugh for being conversation partners. Thank you to Kristen Byerly and Rick Baskett for their continued work as sound engineers. And thank you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.